speaker. What is this, the March the 26th? This is a regular meeting of the Tanana-Yukon Historical Society, and the date is March 26, 1970. And regular meeting, we're having an interview from a prominent Alaskan telling about the early days, and the interviewing member will be Mrs. Magdalene Cassidy. Mrs. Cassidy?
Tonight we have with us Sam Gamble. I think Gamblin. I should have said that. Sam Gamblin. G-A-M-B-L-I-N.
But
was it right in the paper?
Part of it was and part wasn't.
And I've known Sam for quite a while, but he doesn't remember me. But he has been at my home. And
oh, I remember you.
And we've enjoyed knowing him. Sam, where were you born?
New Brunswick, Canada.
Oh, you're a Canadian.
Ex-Canadian. I got civilized.
What year?
1895.
Do you know your mother's and father's name?
Oh, yes. George W. and Hannah Gamblin.
And how many children was there in your family?
12.
12 children. That's about the average in those days, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Where did you go to school?
In New Brunswick.
New Brunswick.
Kalina. 50 miles from St. John would be easier for anybody else that ain't acquainted with the country.
Mm-hmm. And how long did you stay in school?
Till I was 15.
And then you tell us from there on what you did.
Well, folks, this is a new experience for me. I haven't run into anything this before, so some will be offbeat, and some I think you'll enjoy it all, but it'll be different from you ever heard before, I'll promise you that. So I left home Easter Sunday, 1910. That's getting pretty well along. And I came over to New Hampshire, stayed there 3 months, and came west to Idaho. And I worked on what's called a magic dam. It was a big irrigation dam. And I worked there 3 months, and that finished. So then I went into Pocatello, Idaho, and became a machinist helper in the railway shops. And about a year later, I became overhead crane man, Niles Crane. I could lift those big locomotives up just like that, with a 100-ton crane, 40-ton crane, 60-ton crane, and two 10-ton cranes. I was crane foreman. And used to lift those locomotives up, and they put the big wheels in underneath them. And later on, I belonged to the machinist helpers, and they all went on strike and closed the yard down. So I come out, of course, and worked around. And then later, I became a carpenter apprentice in Pocatello. And I joined the union as an apprentice May the 13th, 1913. And I've drove nails off and on ever since. But I couldn't get rich, so I decided to tackle something else. But first, I went from Pocatello to Anaconda, Montana, helped build their zinc concentrator. It was too high for the wife. And I went down to Utah, worked in Salt Lake. She joined me there, and I worked out at Midvale for 3 months. And the foreman, First World War was on, and the foreman was a German. He didn't think much of me as a Canadian, so I agreed with him. It was mutual. So they had the old guard there and the smelter to take care of the work, and they ever broke down, well, then they'd call the boys from town in. Well, I got the habit of going into Salt Lake and staying with my brother-in-law. So I was in one time, and they broke down. They needed all the carpenters they could get, and I wasn't available. So the old man jumped me when I come back, and I said, well, I said, you want me? I said, I think you should let me know. Yeah, but he said, we never know. Well, I said, that's the reason I went to town. There's nothing for me to do here. Well, he said, you better be here. Next Sunday, I went to town, they broke down again. So I knew the handwriting on the wall, so I went over. I didn't go into work, but next door, they was building Midvale Iron and Steel. I went over there and applied for a job, and I got one as a carpenter. Hour less a day and a dollar more in money. So I come back and went in. I got pretty well down in the carpenter shop, and here the old man come along, and he's lame. So he's going along, and about 30 feet away, I called him. Jake, I says, what's the chance to get my time? He says, pretty damn good, pretty damn good. And he wheeled away, he went to make up my time. So I resigned. So I went from there. After we finished the steel mill, I went over to Utah Copper and worked at Garfield and helped build Utah Copper's zinc concentrator and the leaching plant. And they had 700 carpenters, and they didn't have anyone could go high, but Mead & Morrison Construction of Boston had the contract on this leaching plant. And so they came down to the carpenters for Utah Copper and inquired who could go higher. And there's a little Englishman there. I knew him. He'd been in the union when I was an apprentice. Says, Sam, he says, you can go up and see the canal. He says, shall we take it? I says, sure. So we went to work for him. 108 feet in the air, and he says, you work outside, I'll work in. And we're putting on a galvanized sheeting over the frame of the crane where the operator would be, and we had swinging scaffold outside. So I worked outside. I seen the wind blow, so that old scaffold would just go out straight, and I'd lay down and hang on. He'd pull me back in through a window. And we was on putting on the roof one time, and one of our helpers was helping us, and he picked up a sheet flatwise. And the wind started over to take him and the sheet right off the building. I said, flop on your belly and let the sheet go. And he did. The sheet went out and sailed down there about a half a mile. So we worked away there. I was looking up one night after we quit, and I seen one of the steel workers cut the fall line rope on my block and tackle. And if you let the line go through, you're gone. So I spotted it, and I said to the superintendent, and I said, that guy cut the line. Well, he said, we'll be up in the morning. So they went up in the morning, and he cut right out of the middle of the fall line, 300 feet of rope. And so they took the company police and went down to his place, and he towed up the cow with it. So a little later on, it was too high for the wife, too. So I come out to Seattle. And I worked there around town for several years. And then Seattle got overbuilt, so I went on a milk truck. And I worked for the Carnation Company for 3 years after they had bought out the company that I was working for. Oh, I have it. Just a go. Okay. Oh, I see. Pardon me. So then I couldn't get rich on a milk truck, but I was on one for 11 years, house-to-house delivery, and When I left Seattle, I had the biggest retail route in the city of Seattle. I was making 330 stops in 8 hours. And boy, you're getting up and going. So, of course, it was more or less of a dog truck. So when I decided to come north and go prospecting, well, I was hard as nails. I could run 2 or 3 miles and not bat an eye. So I set out for Alaska. I came into Cadova, and flew with Harold Gillum to Chitna, and I come out the highway to Chestachina, and while I was in Seattle, I met a man who claimed to be a prospector, and he had a very rich creek. He invited me to come up with him. Well, I didn't know anything better than to join in. So we come up, came to Chestachina, and bought grub, and one of the road commission cooks went with us, and three other guys
that came up. What year was this?
33.
Alaska.
33. And so we took off with the dog team. We went over in the Mount Sanford district, across from Chestachina, with the 6 dog team, and we traveled 5 days, and we came to this creek. So this fellow that this prospector I met in Seattle, he's quite a talker, but not too much on the work. So before we got over to where we was going to camp, why, he got lame. So I thought it was authentic, so that was all right. So we had to camp up about a mile and a half from where the timberline was. So I could snowshoe. So I went down and I backpacked them up 2 poles at a time to make tent poles. So when we got set up, we opened the end of one tent and opened the end of the cook tent and tied them together, and we come through from one tent into the other. And that was it. So there's 5 of us. So the first night we got set up, I wanted to go out and see what I could see to eat. So I had a rifle and I went out. I traveled and I never seen a caribou. So I didn't know nothing, but all at once over the skyline, here's a flock of horns showing up. And animal like a deer underneath it, and thinks, oh, that's got to be caribou, it can't be nothing else. So I run the willows and I hid down and they come down all around me, and I had a 303 Savage. It's about like a 30-30. And when they were all around me, up with the rifle was empty. Where was the caribou? Of course, I was slightly disappointed. The ribbon I got when I got back to camp, that would make your hair stand. So I went out the next night. And there's another flock come over. But I got my share that night. So they hear me shoot, and the dog musher, who was also the cook, he harnessed them up, and he come up about a mile and a half to where I was. And when the dogs got up there, they all go crazy about caribou. So when they got up there pretty close, they run away, and some of the nigger heads was bare. So they're going over those nigger heads, and the sled bouncing about 3 or 4 foot in the air, and they bounced Barney off. So he came up to where I was, and of course I stopped when they got where the caribou was. And we loaded them up and took them back. So the next day, while we started to sink a hole on this creek, and this guy that got lame in the meantime, he was too sick to work, so he said he'd be cook, which is all right, and we didn't know any better. So I became the guy to do the digging. So we worked away there 2 or 3 days, and the other 3 boys, they went up, oh, maybe a quarter of a mile on the same creek. Oh, the creek was rich, you know, and nuggets as big as walnuts, nothing to it. So I get down about 10, 12 feet, and old Barney calls down and he says, "Hey, Sam, said you got any pliers?" I said, "No, what do we want pliers for?" "Well, I got the toothache." Well, I said, "I doubt very much that there's a pair of pliers and a whole gang, but I'll come up and see." So I crawled out of the hole on the rope, and I didn't have any, so I went up the other boys, and one fella had a little pair about like that. You seen him, these little open jaw pliers? And that's what I had to pull the tooth for. So I've heard this story that you could scare a guy so his tooth would quit aching, so I thought I'd try it. Well, I says, "Barney, this is the best pliers we got, and I'll do the best I can." I says, "Lay down." And he looked and his eyes rolled, and he says, "What for?" Well, I says, "If I start pulling that tooth and you try to get away," I says, "I want to be able to hold you right where I can get it out after I start." So he laid down, and I says, "Pull out your arms." And I got my knees on his arms, and I said, "Well, now," I says, "be careful. I won't hurt you to start with, but once I get a hold, I want to be able to pull it right now." So I didn't even close in on the tooth. I wouldn't touch it with those pliers, but I thought if I could scare him enough, it'd quit. But his arms started to flop. So I says, "What's wrong?" It's quit aching." Well, I says, "Hell, Barney," I says, "while I'm here, I might as well have it out." No, we let it go. So that's my experience as a dentist. God darn, I never forgot it either. Now, I bet he didn't, but the tooth quit aching all right. So I went down 19 feet. It wasn't the color. But I didn't know nothing about panning, so this cripple, he was the guy that done the panning. This is more or less off color, personal experiences. It won't interest some of you, but it's what anyone can go through if they're out in the bush. So I'll tell it to as it happened. So I had bottomed the hole here, and I went over to see what the next hole was. Three of them working on that. And they had about 12 foot of wet, fine sand. And to my mind, it's a wonder it didn't cave right now, because it was damp enough that anything jarred, I figured it would. So I called them out of the hole. I said, "We ain't going to go down on that one anymore. We'll have to crib it if we do, because there's no need of taking a chance of an accident." So I says, "We can go up farther where the hole should be shallower, farther toward the head of the creek, and then we'll put down another one." So they voted for that. So we went up another half mile and started a new hole. Oh, big boulders, you know, and took all five of us to get a rope around the rocks and pull them out. So the cripple was also the panner. And them rocks take chips off the pick. And he was panning, and he had a bull-durham tobacco sack, and he'd dump the cleanup in that. So that was all right. We didn't know nothing about it. So one night it rained, and he left the cleanup in a gold pan. And as dumb as I was, when I seen rust on the on the gold, the platinum, he said, when I seen that turn rusty, I knew we'd been taken. So we held another meeting and voted to quit digging. So we come out. That's my first experience as a prospector. So we come back, come down to Chestachina, across the river on the copper, just about breakup. So I could drive the dogs like nobody's business, and I could run on snowshoes and do most anything. So when we get across the river, we hollered, and one of the Indians come out from Chestachina with a shovel and sounded the ice. Well, it didn't look good to us because there's open water up here, open water down below, and I can't swim with a darn. So we went in the woods and we got some poles about 25 foot long. We tied them to tides of the sled, and then the Barney, the dog owner,
He went across first, and he had a good team of dogs, they minded. And then he sent the dogs back one at a time, and we go across with these poles tied out on the sled. In case we break through, the dogs would pull us up. So we got back to camp. But we only got down with one load of grub, and we had about two loads up at the hunting camp, where Mabesna used to have a hunting camp in the fall for meat for the mine. And he could talk Indian, and they talked, and we come into Chestachina and called the deal off. But he invited the Indians to come over and eat up the grub we brought back, which they did very nicely. So that was the first trip. So then the fellow there at Chestachina, he's a Norwegian, I believe, and oh, there's big money to be made in running a fish wheel, getting fish for dog feed, salmon, you know, and dry them and smoke them. And we'd decided that we'd go into Shoshana, that's the old camp at that time, but we would go in there and try our luck, because he knows one crick that maybe held some money. So I got busy on the truck, and I worked for about 2 months hauling truck for the roadhouse, or food, and at the same time I was hauling a few pounds for myself and getting jobs for the different prospectors along the highway. So all together we had close to 2 tons. So when we got through, it come time to go to Shoshana, the trail was closing, and Nabesna was had the ore trucks on the road, and anyway, they're going up empty, and they give us a lift. We got as far as Caribou Creek. That was as far as the road was at that time. So then we bought a best part of a dog team, and we needed some more dogs. So I was in Valdez, and they had one down at the Cliff Mine. They wouldn't let him stay in town because he barked so, but he was down there and the guy wanted to give him away. Well, I had intentions of buying him, but no, he said he'd give it to me. But if I'd pay for the halter and the chain, why, that'd be fine. So it was a nice big black dog, and husky and smart apparently, and gentle. I petted it, you know, and got acquainted with it, and so I decided I would take it. So I set out with it, going over Valdez Summit. I loaded, I was all alone, the other fellas. When they closed the trail, Chitna Cash Store had about 50 or 60 ton in Valdez, and they had to get over the trail before the road closed. Because up in Thompson Pass, they let it close then 6 months. So I was driving all along, so I took out any time I get loaded, I just take right out. So I had this dog chained over to that side of the cab, and it was a 4 mile hill then, and I had an old Chevrolet truck, and I had about 3 ton on it, it was only a ton truck, and coming up that hill was quite low, but I was in low gear for a long while. And all at once, so I looked at that dog, and his eyes were green, you know, and that was unusual. So all at once he made a drive at my throat. I got my elbow up. And I had to drive a little ways farther before I could get where it was smooth enough to stop. So I did. And then I got out, and I couldn't make friends with that dog, but I had the 22 rifle in the back of the cab, and there was nothing else to do. I had to shoot him. So I lowered the boom on him, and I shot him. And then I dragged him out, and dragged him off the highway, and piled him up on the snowbank, and got back in again. And there went our dog. So I went down the road about a quarter of a mile, and the fellow over the summit, before the freeze that night, was Colonel Revelle, used to own Black Rapids. And here's his dual-wheel tires, and I had singles. So froze hard, and I slipped off in the ditch. So I unloaded the load, the best part of it, and I couldn't get out, so I think I'll tackle it in daytime. So I curled up in the seat. I had some wool robes with me. Got up in the morning, and Tomikins woke me up. Bright, clear day, you know, and Tomikins flying all over. And I get out, and the snow was froze. Thinks I, well, gee whiz, I can probably pull out now because things are froze. I had chains. So I pulled out, and then I put the load back on, and I got thinking. Well, now, by golly, that's a nice dog hide. I've heard about dog hide parkers. I didn't see why it wouldn't be all right to take his hide. And so I went up and skinned him out. Cold black. And come to find out, if you please, half wolf. Well, that's one of the reasons why he went crazy. But so I went on down, and I stopped at the first road commission camp, and of course I knew all the cooks on the road. And, when did you eat last? It was yesterday noon. Well, there's cake, cold meat, bread and butter. I'm busy getting dinner. Help yourself. So I did. And I got up then and went to the phone and called Tekill and called Mrs. Romer. And I says, Ines, I broke, stuck down on the summit last night. And I'm just on the way in. I'm at the road commission camp, and I'll be in about an hour and a half for dinner. Will you have it? Well, sure. But while I was getting acquainted with that dog, he bit me 14 times. He made his teeth meet down through here, and my hand got about that thick. So I ain't too much of a doctor, but I knew Epsom salts was the best thing I could put on it. So I come on down the highway, and a prospector by the name of Fred Reese was at Ernestine. And I stopped in there, I had a quarter of beef for him. And I took it into him, and what do you owe you? I says, you don't owe me nothing. But I said, I got bit last night by the dog I had with me, and I says, I guess he was part wolf. Well, he says, when I was a kid, he says, I got bit by an otter. Mother put onions on it. But he says, we ain't got no fresh onions. Well, I says, dried onions would be just as good to my mind. And if you got some, I'll put on a poultice. So I did. And I went on, and Ines had dinner ready, and I ate, and I went on for Copper Center, and I got in there, and I was heading for Galcana. Well, there's where my load went. And I built a fire in the stove at Copper Center, and I got hot water, and I got Epsom salt, and I soaked my hand for about an hour and a half. And I took some nuts and salts with me, and I went on to Galcana, and I started another fire, and I shook my hand, and then I got up in the morning. In the meantime, they'd unloaded the load, and I had it back. So while I was loading up, the Indians had about a ton and a half of Red Cross supplies and Valdez that they wanted hauled out, and nobody would haul out unless they got paid for it. And I always had a soft spot for the Indians, so I told them, I says, I'll take it. So when I come to Copper Center, the Indian village there, they met me and they unloaded it. And I went on, I didn't take nothing for it. And when I come back the next day, I had an Indian on the road watching for me. So I come along, and the Indian council had met and selected one of two Indians to ride with me while my hand was laid up and do the work, loading and unloading, and help me until my hand was better. So I selected one of them, and he rode with me about a month and a half, and I paid his room and board in town. So ever since that time, I've still been pretty good with the Indians all over the territory. But that was just the one trip. So then we starts up toward Nabesna to go towards Shoshana overland through Cooper Pass with a dog team. And my partner was with me.
Who was he?
Huh?
What's his name?
Bill Paulson. He's now dead. He died over in the Canadian side. But before that, the lady at the roadhouse had occasion to go to Valdez, and I was driving the roadhouse truck, so it was to me to take her in. And so we was over there. We built two fish wheels up a couple of hundred yards upstream on the copper from the mouth of the Chestachina River. And I wanted my partner to come over with me. We had a long, narrow boat, and then go back with the boat. And when I come, I would shoot, and he'd come after me, but he wouldn't do that. So I went over, and they had about a 100-foot line on the boat, so I put it away in the back in the alders, because in the spring, why, the current eats up the bank lots of times, and you lose, maybe 10, 15, 20 feet at a different time. So I didn't want to take no chance. So when I come back, we was in Valdez about a week. The road washed out and we had to work a passage out. So when we come back, I went over and there's a slough went off the Chestachina and down and joined the copper. It was only water about up to your ankles. So when I get over there, well, it rained almost all the time we was gone. And we started to eat the bank up where we had our camp. So we went back inland about a couple of hundred feet, and he cut a lot of trees down about 4 or 5 foot high, and he cut cross timbers on them, and we had about a ton and a half of dried salmon. So he carried it back. He spent 4 days up on that scaffold waiting for the water to get down. It flooded everything. So he learned his lesson from that. So then we went on up with an abandoned truck, and we went as far as Caribou Creek. That was the end of the road. So there's a shelter cabin built by the government, or rather hired, built by the government, at Jack Lake. It's about 8 inches of snow, and it turned 50 below. So that wasn't too bad, but in this cabin, I guess it was built in a hurry. It wasn't corked very good anyway. When we sat in there, it was real cold. But there used to be a lady druggist in Valdez, and I read a lot. So she says, Sam, she says, I got a lot of magazines upstairs. If you want to sort them through, I'll give you all you want to take. And you can. I know you're going inside where there's nothing to read. So I went up there and I sorted them over, and I got 3 gunny sacks full of magazines. And so that was part of our equipment. So we landed them there at the Jack Lake cabin, and everything was froze down. So much as I hate to do it, I had to tear them pages apart of those magazines and use them for caulking in that cabin, make it so we could live in it. And the wind would flicker the candle and sometimes would blow it out on you. But that couldn't be helped. So I got it all corked. In the meantime, Bill was running the dog team, and the wind was blowing snow, and it was just like hail, real fine and froze. And so one night he came in blind, but he was riding a sled, and the lead dog came to the door and scratched on the door, and I went and let him in, and got him, he was blind as a bat. It was 2 days there, he couldn't see nothing. But the dog team brought him in. So in the meantime, while I was waiting for him to get better, he got the last load up. Well, I went outside and I cut small trees, and I stood them up under the eaves, and then I carried snow from about 50, 60 feet and carried it in there and went out to Jack Lake and cut ice and thawed it on the stove, went out and threw water on the snow so it wouldn't end up blow away. So it's about time we got that done, it's time to move. So we went on up in the basement. Then I got a letter from my boy. He said, Dad, everybody out here is out of work. You better come out and go to work. So I did. I went down with Tommy Hike, who just passed away last fall. The old timer down the Copper River Valley. And He hauled me down. I didn't have much with me but my snowshoes and Nat Brown, that used to fly out of Cadova and Chittenden around in there. He came in with a load of passengers headed for Cadova. So the boats didn't always stop in Valdez, so I wanted to get to Cadova. So I'd help them load up and wrestle baggage and everything. They invited me to ride along, so I did. So I traded them my snowshoes for a trip to Cadova from Valdez. So then I got where I get a wire out, and I sent for some money, and I got outside, steerage, of course. And
what year was that?
I made it all right.
Huh? What year was that?
34, if you please. I just got here. So I went out, and I come back in the next spring. So I went over to Shoshana, but I'd sent my rifle in the fall before with him with the dog team. So when he come to go over, I didn't have nothing but a .22 pistol. So in the spring, and the bears were coming out, and I didn't have no rifle, but I thought I could maybe holler loud enough and rattle a tin can that they wouldn't bother me. And there's lots of bears over in the Notch Creek country going across the Shoshana. But I got through, nothing bothered me, and then I went up to my partner, and he was camped up there. Had the food downtown, what he had left, and we went up onto I can't think of the name of the creek. Anyway, the lower end of it had been worked a little bit. We was going to put in a booming dam on the upper end and work the balance of it. So we worked away there about 3 weeks, and I got down into clay up on the flat. This is above Bonanza, and it was a canyon creek. And I got down to where about 3 foot, and a real sticky clay. Well, I could get a cent or two to the pan, but you had to puddle it all the time and dissolve it. So then we commenced to check up on the grub, and we didn't have any. So I wanted to know why, and well, I'd found out then. I'd got acquainted with some of the other guys, and they told me that he'd been peddling grub to the Indians all the way along the line. He didn't arrive with only a little bit. And when I come to check up, I got a sack of sugar and a half a sack of flour and some butter out of 2 tons. So I thought that was enough. It's time to split the blanket. So we did. So I went with my partner there, the fellow I was staying with, that owned the Chestachina Roadhouse. He was working a bench on the side of Bonanza Creek, and he was cleaning up some bedrock. Well, I was just killing time till I got my breath, and by golly, I fell through to help clean bedrock. No, we cleaned a spot probably as big as the other side of the table here to the wall. And you could see we were shoveling in gold, and we pick up bedrock about 12 inches deep and wash it in water and in the box. And so when he come to panning, he let me pan it. So I had one of the big gold pans, so there's 1.5 or 2 inches of gold in it. It come out for better than $400. So that's the first gold I panned. So I stayed around a while, and Earl Lewis, and this is Earl Hurst, that used to own and built the Chestachina Roadhouse. At the moment, he's right here in town. He's a watchman for Dean Patty up on Coal Creek and Woodchopper. So I helped him for a little bit, and then he told me about some hard rock, and that interested me more than the placer. So we staked some hard rock and done some work on it. And General A.D. McRae of Canada, Bob Reeves, was doing the flying in there, and he'd done some flying for him, and he got him interested in it. He's a millionaire, money man. So we worked Another old fellow and I, we worked there almost 3 years. We opened up a bunch of veins and put open cuts in them and traced them out and fanned them and had assays and everything. And our Jerome was a geologist. He came in to examine it. And it looked good enough to him. He wanted to put on a mill. But Dean Patty, who you all know, no doubt, was the operating engineer. And he said, no, you're too far from transportation. It was about 100 miles from the Besna over. And the road commissioner was ready to put in a road. They'd surveyed a road across and for two bridges over the Besna River and the Shoshana into Shoshana town. So they voted it down, so that settled up. And so then I come out and went to work around town, prospected out of Cadova and followed around down there, Prince William Sound, all over. And each fall, I put up grub and gasoline for about a 2 month trip around all over the sound, examining the old prospects they had found all over. So there was a widow down on the Naked Island group, Mrs. Clark, and she had six children. So all she had a blue fox farm, and the sound, there were several blue fox farms all over different places. So everybody that could always got her some deer, some goats or something, so the family would have meat. So we did the same. So on one trip, we went down to Montague. They allow four deer down there now in the fall, but at that time there was three. So we went down there on a deer hunt. Before we left Cadova, the young fellow in there was a baker for the FE company. And he came in a month early, and here he is in Cadova and didn't know what to do, and he didn't drink any to speak of, so he wanted to get out of town. So he jumped me to know if he could go with us on this trip. Well, I says, there's room in the boat, there's only three of us, and if it's all right with the boys, it's all right with me, we got lots of grub. Oh, he says, I'll cook. He says, I can make pie and bake cake and everything. Well, I says, we all cook. But if you want to go, there's no reason why you can't. So he went along. So he couldn't get a rifle, but he borrowed a Ross rifle. That's the ex-Canadian Army rifle that they built when I was a kid. He had three shells. And I told him, I said, that ain't very many. Oh, he says, that's enough. If I get a chance at a deer, I'll get him. So we went into Zakoff Bay. That's a little harbor on the inside of Montague. And he was the first on the shore outside the man that rode him in, and he took right up over the bank. It was about 10, 15 foot raise, and bang! Well, there's me. Jimmy's got a deer. We get up there. Jimmy had a new Filson coat on and new pants, and he'd taken his coat off, and he's rolling up his sleeves and his back to the deer all the time, and turned around to cut the deer's throat. Mr. Deer get up and left. God damn. Here we are, our tongues hanging out for fresh meat, and he let the deer get away. So that's the way that little trip went. But that wasn't the end of it. So they'd hunted all that day, five of us. Wait a minute, four of us. And hadn't got no deer. So the captain says to me, Sam, Tom, he's a 16-year-old boy, this widow's oldest son. He'd never been hunting before, so we took him along. 16 years old. But I had a octagon gauge barrel 22 special. It was a good gun, you know, but not big enough for any distance. But he was a good shot, so. Sam, you let Tom hunt with you today. So I says, all right, that's fine. Tom, I says, I'll tell you what we'll do. You and I'll cross the island, down the other beach, away from camp, come back up on top, And then if we jump a deer, we'll drive them toward camp. Well, that's fine. So we did. We went up on top, big high timber, no brush. Just as clear as could be. So we're sneaking along in the... Oh, here's a deer trail, about that wide and about that deep in the moss, see? And we both had chew packs on, going along, all eyes, you know, looking around. And down a little ways, oh, there's a tree there that must have been 8 or 9 foot across. Well, as a kid, you know, I was raised down the Brunswick with a few bear there and everything else, and I'd heard stories about bears and hollow trees and all of that old stuff, so things are, gee whiz, if that was just a hollow tree, well, there'd be a possibility of a bear in it. But it's a live tree, and there's no chance of that, so we come along, and the trail went about 2 feet from the base of this tree. When we got right in here, about 20 feet over there, here's some fresh dirt. Well, as green as I was, I didn't know of anything that made a pile of fresh dirt unless it was a bear. And I couldn't see no sign of one, so I took another step or two, and bang, here's a big hole. About 3.5 foot one way and about 4 foot high. The lady was home. The bear was laying back in this end of the den. And she come out, and she had to turn toward me, and when she did, her mouth was about like that. So all I had was this little 303 Savage, and I up from the hip and pointed at her and pulled the trigger. Well, the safety's right by the trigger. And I hit her in the side of the throat and swung her down the mountainside. Oh, the mountainside's about like that. She made about 20 feet, and I had two more in her, and she piled up. Well, when she went down, she was so big and fat, this a week before Thanksgiving. Well, she slid down the hill a little bit, and her head kind of went under her chest. And I says, Tom, well, the Indians tell me that when you kill a brown bear, you'd better wait a few minutes before you go near it, because sometimes the shock knocks them out, but they come too. So I says, we won't take no chances. We sat back to back, you watch one way and I'll watch the other. We did. So we waited a while, no movement. So I says, you stay here, Tom, I'll go down and take a look. I went down the way around, and the eyes were glassy and she was bleeding at the nose. And I went around and I poked her with the rifle from the back side. And I says, I guess she's dead all right, Tom. Come on down. So he started down, and I'm standing there looking at her real brave, you know, and her head was kind of under her chest, so I think that, gee whiz, I'd like to see how long she is. And she's about as wide as this table, the way she's flapping out. So I straddled her, and I grabbed her by the hair of the head, and I heaved on her, and oh, Jesus, I went up high enough that I could have shot her from the air. And you think I wasn't scared? So that's just another trip. So no deer meat yet. So I says, well, Tom, maybe they didn't get a deer. And maybe we'd better take in some meat with us. Well, he says, Sam, he says, I don't think you can eat bear meat. Well, I says, I know you can eat black because I already have, but we can job Jimmy. And I says, I'll do the cooking. So I says, you cut out about 15, 20 pounds right out of the ham and we'll pack it in. And the hide. I carried the hide and he carried part of the ham. So we got in there and nobody had any deer. So these Indians, they're right smart, all half-breeds. And what are you going to do? I says, I'm going to feed Jimmy some bear meat. Yeah, but he can't eat it. Yeah, he says, he don't know that. Here's a good place for him to learn. I got busy with a bear steak and got the pan hot. We had a little coal stove, you know. I got the pan hot. And now I says, Jimmy, the way to eat bear meat is eat it piping hot. And I says, this will be real good. So you get ready. And he got all set there, you know. And I dished out the bear. He bit off a chunk and apparently got bigger and bigger. I kept my face straight, but when it was cooking, I got some cinnamon sprinkled on the stove to change the odor. That sure tasted, smelled of fish. Oh, God. He says, I can't eat that. Well, I said, what do you mean you can't eat that? Well, it tastes fishy. He says, you sure? Yeah, I said, give me a piece. And I whittled off a piece and tasted it all right. Of course, it was so fishy you couldn't even look at it, let alone eat it. So that settled the dinner. But we did get some deer. So then I came in to Cadova and I worked the carpenter work around there and I traveled with the boys. And so Parks's cannery bought a marine boiler over at Catella and on Bering River. And they sent one of the tugboats and a scow after it. So I wasn't doing nothing, so I went along as a deckhand. So the captain, he drank all night, and when he come to piloting the ship, the next day, the big salmon tender, about 60, 70 foot long, why, he laid down, slept, and the cook, he was navigator. So we got over to Bering River and went in there, and there's a big cannery there that wasn't in use anymore, so we got this big marine boiler on this scow and got it loaded on. Well, he says, we won't start back till tomorrow. Well, I said, if you ain't going back tomorrow, I said, I'm going down the beach and see if I can find a bear. I said, there should be some black bear out and good eating. Well, I'm going with you. Well, I didn't want him with me. I said, you ain't got no rifle. Oh, but I got a shotgun. And he couldn't hardly stand up, and that didn't suit me either. But anyway, we took off. Got down there in the skunk cabbage. That's what the black bear or any other bear first tackles in the spring. And here's one eating skunk cabbage. So I get up about as close as I thought I could get, and I let drive at him, and I wounded him and knocked him down, but he got up into the brush, going up the mountainside, he hit a little crevice, a little stream bed, and he went up that, and I trailed him. But I got him to stay back. He couldn't have climbed that mountain through the brush. So I get up there, and by golly's, that bear went over the second range, and I followed it, but it was getting close to dark, so I thought, well, I'll have to give it up and head back. So I just turned around to head back when here's a bear shows up over there about 30 feet. And just as I shot, here's a little cub about that high. I wouldn't have shot her if I'd seen the cub, but I'd already shot. And I wounded the cub just enough to make him scream, so he went up a tree. And so then he was crying just like a baby, and so I shot him to kill him so he wouldn't call any more bears, because I'd shot enough ammunition at him, I didn't have too much left. So I skinned him out and brought it in. So we took off for Cadova the next day. Got down there opposite the Copper River, and by golly's, the tow line broke. Now here's this big scow with this 10-ton boiler on it, dashing around, weighs about 8 or 10 foot high, and me's a deckhand. So they make a dive at it, and if we didn't just jibe right, I didn't jump. But we made one trip, and I managed to make the grade and got aboard. So there was a cable on the scow, and I got that, and I put a line on it and a little block of wood, and then I paid the line out, and they picked it up with a power boat, and then they pulled the cable board and got it harnessed up again. So we come back to Cadova. So that was that trip. So that fall, Puget Sound Tug and Barge had a tugboat Royal that they'd been towing around Prince William Sound. They had done some work there in the breakwater. And they all started out, and they got in a storm. Well, they got blown ashore on Hayak Island. That'll be about 60 miles below Cadova. The island is practically flat. But anyway, there was such a storm and the waves were going into the timber, 3 or 4 foot of water up. But they all got ashore without anybody getting drowned. And there was a man there by the name of Cap Lagatha. You've all heard of the early days of the polar bear. He had salvaged that and he had it in Cadova. So he was a diver. So he took a contract to go down and salvage this tugboat Royal. So I went along as deckhand, of course, in a small boat this time. So we gets down there, and here's the boat down, water all around her at high tide. But at low tide, here's the sandbank. She's inland about a half a mile. But on high tide, if she floated, we could pull her out, see? So we went in there after. And all the holes on the deck, I plugged and around at low tide. But there must have been some underneath. But I built a cofferdam around the hatch. And in this forward cabin was the food supplies, a lot of canned goods, you know, for the boat to go to Seattle with. And this guy went around there with a diving suit on. He never went down the food hole to get us some grub. He just left us without grub. So we tied up to the mast of the sunken tugboat, and he would go down at high tide and prowl around, but he never brought any grub up. So a storm come up. But before we started to work on the tugboat, we had sounded a passage clear over to Catella and took 50-gallon drums and cabled them to heavy weights along this channel for about 10 miles. So if we had to run for shelter, we could make it. So the storm come up all right, and boy, we headed for home. And when we got over toward Catella, why, pitch dark. And here I am, tied to the cabin rail with a 20-foot pike pole. When the boat would go down, I'd reach and come up. That guy went in through there and up the channel and into Bering River channel up in the timber with that boat blacker than a stack of cats. So we gets over there and we had to abandon it. So we go into Catella and we stays there 2 or 3 days and we takes on water. And there was two men there, and they had a small boat, 23 or 4 footer, with a cabin on it, and about a 7 foot little rowboat. One of them was the brother of the New England cannery superintendent. The other fellow was part Indian, named Fitzgibbon. So they waited till we were ready to go across, and then they would go with us. So that was all right, because those guys I was with, they could go anywhere, fog, rain, or snow. It didn't make no difference. So we starts out, and they follows us, and then their engine breaks down, and we put a tow line on them, and we tow them. Well, we get over up at the mouth of Copper River, and the wind blew us inshore, and we went up a slough Well, then it turned cold and everything froze. And the ice froze us in, and here we are. And the tide going up and down, and icebergs, flat cakes going by. And didn't look too hot, but we sat tight. If the wind blew straight while we was in this channel, we was all right. But if they came across wind, it would blow these ice cakes crosswise, and the boat would sweep out over land and cut the bottom off, and then we'd be wrecked. But we had a big skiff aboard. So that was all right. We stood her out. And so they, meantime, worked on the boat, got it ready to go. And the next morning, when it looked like the wind had gone down and the tide was carrying the ice out, while we went out with it. So instead of them waiting until we get out and disconnected from them, as soon as I disconnected them, they took off. Well, they didn't know where they were going. They didn't know where the channel was. First thing they done, they go over there about a quarter of a mile and run aground on the dry bar, see? And missed the channel that we was in, and we couldn't get in to reach them. So we had to go off and leave them. So we went into Cadova and alerted the Coast Guard.